Good morning and welcome to Talking About California, our series of discussions about California, a place where Californians who talk about themselves, their lives, and their work here. I'm Cal Winslow. I'm the director of the Mendocino Institute, and I'm your host today. This morning, we're headed for the trenches in our so far never-ending healthcare crisis in this country. We're going to talk with a healthcare practitioner and frontline healthcare activist. Our guest is Katie Romer. Katie Romer is a registered nurse at Kaiser Oakland, and she's an active member of the California Nurses Association. She works there as a postpartum nurse, and she's active in a union also affiliated with the National Nurses Association, which is known for fighting for its members, but also one which has been for a long time in the forefront of the movement for healthcare reform. I should add, she wanted me to say that she's the proud mom of two boys, and she likes to garden, and she likes to read, and I don't know how she finds the time for this, but I guess we'll find out. Good morning, Katie.
Hi, Cal. Thank you.
Can I call you Katie?
Absolutely.
Good. Well, Katie, you've told me more than once that you really love your work. So let's begin with that. And just tell us a little bit, and give us some detail about what you do as a registered nurse at Kaiser Oakland.
Well, I'm a postpartum nurse, and I work on a unit where we get the moms and the babies a few hours after the baby has been delivered. And so we're not in with them during the delivery, but really we're in that whole incredible process that happens after a mom and baby meet one another and are learning to have a kind of a dance. So the baby has to learn how to eat, you know, the baby has to is still kind of coordinating all of the different kind of processes to be alive that are very new, you know, breathing and swallowing and all of the things that a baby needs to do that they've never had to do in the womb. And a mom, often if it's her first baby, is learning how to be, what does it mean? Everyone prepares for the moment of the birth. And often that's what the whole 9 or 10 months is about. And really that's only the beginning. And so there are often, you know, women who are pretty overwhelmed with the fact that now they actually have an infant to take care of. And so there's a lot of education that I do, a lot of just kind of showing a mom what it is to be a mom. And then there's all the medical. So our labor and delivery in Oakland is a level 3 labor and delivery. So we get the most ill mothers that are delivering, so they can have all kinds of complications associated with the kind of health problems that you might see, whether that's a heart problem or diabetes or high blood pressure or any number of things that might just be occurring in their life generally, and things that might happen that are specific to pregnancy, like high blood pressure that's just associated with pregnancy. And so we're managing all of those health issues with a mom and then any health issues that a baby might have, even though most of the time the babies that we take care of are well babies. Anything can happen. So we're doing the medical, and we're doing this whole support for the natural process that it is to have a baby. So I feel incredibly lucky to do what I do. I love patient care. I love, you know, there's nothing like holding a newborn infant. It's an incredible honor, you know, within 2 to 3 hours of its birth, and showing parents how to take care of that infant and feel comfortable when they go home that they can do what they need to do.
So it sounds like you're a teacher.
Very much so.
Well.
But, you know, almost all nurses are. There's so much that patients need to learn in the hospital, no matter what, you know, role you're playing as a nurse. We help them to learn about how to take care of themselves. In my case, how to take care of themselves and to take care of the infant that they've just had. Or if that infant is particularly ill and ends up in intensive care, which is not where I work, I'm helping the mom and the family to cope with that and to do what they need to do to take care of themselves and to prepare for when they can be reunited with that infant. But all nurses have a incredibly huge teaching role that we do that often isn't all that recognized, but it's really important.
And time-consuming?
Very much so, and increasingly difficult because often that is not part of what you do that's recognized as something that's really important, and time isn't necessarily allocated or not sufficient time allocated for us to be able to do that important role. So we're struggling to fit it in all the time. I mean, whenever we're in the room with a patient, some sort of education for that patient's going on.
And nurses today for Kaiser, do you work Monday, Friday, 9 to 5? Or?
You know, mostly we have incredibly variable schedules depending on what your role is. But nurses work every, if you're in the hospital, generally you'll work every other weekend and then some sort of schedule during the week. And we call it your schedule is a two-week schedule. So you'll work some sort of portion of those days with a weekend in there and then interspersed throughout the week. So it's really different depending. One of the beauties of being a nurse is that you can work part-time if you want to. There's very few nurses that are taking care of patients in the hospital that work 40 hours a week, partly because the work is just so hard. It's really physically taxing. And so to work 40 hours a week is really hard on your body. So most nurses work a 32-hour week rather than a 40-hour week. But there are some that can do 40 and do it.
Okay.
I'm not one of those.
No, you're not one of those. You got your garden to attend to.
Well, yeah, you should see it now. Not so much, but.
All right. Well, let's step back then, and I wanted to ask you about how you became a nurse, but maybe you could tell listeners, if you don't mind, just a little bit about yourself. I think you told me you were born here in California, but raised in the Midwest.
Yeah, I'm a native. I was born in San Jose, California, and I grew up about 5 years in San Jose before my parents, who are both from the Midwest in northern Indiana, decided to move back. My dad was in a job that he was not liking all that much, and so decided to go back to the Midwest. So I grew up from the time I was 5 years old until the time I went off to college in the Midwest. And so I'm a kind of a product of both places. I consider myself a Californian, very much so. It's kind of this is my home. I've lived now more years in California than I have anywhere else, and just kind of by nature, I'm a Californian. But I also really have a Midwestern ethic. It is that hardworking, you know, very earnest kind of Midwestern ethos that I very much have as well. And I regularly am back in the Midwest. I love Chicago. Grew up going to Chicago, and I regularly visit a brother that I have there. And my parents now don't live in Indiana anymore. They live on Lake Michigan. So we go back almost every year to Lake Michigan.
Okay, your voice is going down a bit, Katie. And you love basketball, I guess.
Somewhat, yes. I mean, I grew up watching the college basketball in the Midwest, and both Indiana University and University of Notre Dame. I don't have time anymore to follow very much, but yeah.
So you chose UC Berkeley, though? Is that, am I right?
You know, there? I have a really checkered university pass. I actually started at the University at Indiana University in Bloomington. Hmm. And then I did a transfer to Mexico City. And that was an exchange program that I did that was absolutely transformative in my life and really kind of set me on the path that I'm on now. I was had grown up mostly in the Midwest at that point and ended up going off to Mexico, and that was the first time that I really truly looked back at my own culture and society from a really different perspective. And it sent me to, that's what ended up getting me to California.
Do you want to say something about your experience?
Sure.
Mexico?
I was very much a Midwesterner. I grew up in a fairly, you know, homogeneous place in northern Indiana. Mishawaka was the name of the city that I grew up in. And when I went off to Mexico, I wasn't really sure what to expect. I had a high school, you know, preparation to speak Spanish. And when I was in Mexico City, I was living in what was then the largest city in the world. And I really chose to throw my lot in with the Mexican family that I was living with, I really wanted to learn Spanish. And so the way to do that was to hang out with people that spoke Spanish. And so I really kind of separated myself a little bit from the American group that I'd gone down with, because I really wanted to have a true cultural experience and to learn the language. And it flipped my life around. I learned to just love Mexico. I learned to speak Spanish fairly fluently. And also as I took classes at the university in Mexico City, they really, you know, looked at the United States from a perspective that I had never had growing up. Learning American history in the United States is really different from looking at Mexican history and American history from the, you know, Mexican perspective and looking at economics. And so it really taught me about perspective and looking at things from a different perspective. And I'll never forget, one of the things that we did was go to a slum in Mexico City, and it was Nezahualcóyotl, and it was one of the biggest slums in the world. And I remember getting into an argument with an American student that was from the university in the United States about kind of the origins of poverty. And, you know, he was saying, well, these people have a choice in where they are, and they choose to live the way that they live. And I couldn't believe that someone could have that perspective, and that what we were seeing was something that any human being would choose. So it really, you know, made me look at, you know, the people in the world and, you know, and poverty and how people deal with the circumstances of their lives in a new way. And I came back to the United States, and I applied to the University of California at Berkeley. And I started to, my major ended up being Latin American Studies, because I really wanted to continue to learn about that kind of different perspective about history and economics and sociology and anthropology, and ended up thinking that Berkeley was my home. And I live now in Berkeley, and consider this to be my true home. This is the where I feel I belong. That was that journey. And it's really, impacted me throughout my whole life, how I approach people. And being able to speak Spanish has been just an incredible gift. I use it every time I take care of patients in the hospital. I can have, help people have a different experience because I can speak to them in their native language. I can explain things, educate people in their native language, and I get an insight into their lives that I never would have had I not had that experience.
Well, then maybe we should, Berkeley to nursing?
Yeah, no, there was a long period of time. I did my first undergraduate. I have two undergraduate degrees, so my first undergraduate degree was from Berkeley in Latin American Studies, and then I spent my 20s kind of having a lot of really boring jobs. There wasn't a whole lot that you could use a degree in Latin American Studies to do that was very interesting. And I started to look around and think, it has always been really, really important to me to make a difference in the world, to have a sense of that what I was doing in the world would make the world a better place. That was something that has been taught to me from an early age from my parents, that we have a responsibility in the world to do what we can to make it a better place for people, not just for ourselves, but for our larger society. And so nursing, I thought, would do a lot of that, it would be very concrete for me what the impact that I would be having on people's lives. And also as a woman, I really, interestingly, thought of nursing from kind of a feminist perspective, because I never wanted to be dependent on someone else for my livelihood, and I didn't want to have to make decisions in my life I didn't want to make economic decisions based on being dependent, and I knew nursing would provide me that kind of independence, but also it would give me kind of a flexibility in my life. I could work part-time. I could, you know, if I chose to be with my kids, I would be able to do that and still make a living that would be decent. And so I thought at one point I might be a chiropractor or a social worker, and decided that nursing would allow me to have, a life that I could, I could do what I wanted to. If I had kids, I would be able to, take care of them if need be, and also then make a real concrete difference. And that has been absolutely true. Every day when I walk off my unit, I know what I've been able to do for people. It's very concrete.
So you went back to school?
Yeah, no, I went back. So I had my first degree. I went back to all the community colleges in the Bay Area. I have attended them. I went to Laney and Merritt and Vista and all the different community colleges because I needed to do prerequisites for science. I had had a Bachelor of Arts, right? So I didn't have a science background. And as a nurse, I needed a really solid science background. So I went and I did all the prerequisites while I was working to qualify for nursing school. And then I applied to University of San Francisco because they had an accelerated program, and I could do that in 2 years and get a Bachelor of Science in Nursing. And that would, that at that point, that was kind of the premier degree for nursing. There's a lot of different entrance routes into nursing. You can get an associate degree, or you can get a bachelor's, or you can, there's a lot of different ways to do it. And so, I could do this in doing these prerequisites, and then I could do it in 2 years and have a bachelor's degree. And then I went to work. I started working, and I started out at a community clinic as a new graduate. I had worked as a health educator while I was going to nursing school, and I got a job in a local clinic that mostly dealt with low-income patients. And as a new graduate, I still kind of can't believe I did this work, but I basically ordered all the supplies for that new clinic. I put them in place. I did, all of the nursing duties. I was the only nurse there. I put all the equipment into all of the rooms. I roomed the patients. I educated the patients. I oversaw the assistants, and it was an incredible education. But I always wanted to deal with moms and babies. So when a job opened up at a local hospital at Alta Bates, I took it and worked there for about 5 years, and then ended up going over to Kaiser. It's a long, complicated story about how Kaiser used to deliver outside of Kaiser in the Oakland. And then they switched back and went back into the Kaiser Oakland Hospital that they are in now. And I joined up with Kaiser at that point.
And so since then, you've been at Kaiser?
I've been there about 8 years.
Right.
As a postpartum nurse in the same unit. I tend to stick around when I do a job.
Okay. I want to tell the listeners, this is KZYX. My name is Cal Winslow. I'm your host at Talking About California, or program this morning. Today I'm talking to Katie Romer, who's a registered nurse at Kaiser in Oakland, and we're talking about nursing, and we're going to now talk about activism, I guess, and nursing. Got some time to get into this in some detail, so maybe you've just been talking about your experience in Mexico and your family, about an ethos of caring for other people. Isn't nursing enough? Do you have to be an activist too?
Well, I didn't ever intend when I went into nursing to become an activist. And I just, as I started to do the work, I mean, when you first become a nurse, what you do is you are so concerned about your ability to take care of people. Your learning curve is so sharp that that's kind of all you can deal with. So probably the first, 3 years of your career, for some people it's even longer, that's what you're focused on. You're focused on being able to take care of people and doing the tasks that you need to do. Nursing is really complex. You know, not only are you a teacher, but you have to manage fairly complex equipment. You know, I think so often the public misunderstands what nurses do and thinks that we are kind of these caring angel types. And we have to have incredibly sophisticated medical knowledge to take care of patients in the current. Patients are getting sicker. They're in the hospital for shorter lengths of stay. Nurses have to be really savvy on a lot of different levels. And I feel like sometimes we haven't been as good at educating the public about what it is that we do. So there's a lot of misunderstanding about how sophisticated our work is. And how much we do to care for those patients. And so I think initially that's what I was focused on. I focused on the ability to do the tasks, to do, you know, to learn all of the different things that I needed to learn to be a really excellent nurse, because that's what I wanted to be, and I think most nurses do. But then I started to look around and say, there are limits in terms of how good I can be at my work, and those limits, some of those limits were external. And I think one of my really big pushes to become an activist was the passage of the ratios. When I worked at Alta Bates in Berkeley, and it used to be a small independent hospital, and the ratios passed, and, you know, before ratios, we could have up to 14 patients. I mean, I can't even tell you how awful that sounds to me right now. And there was we could have 7 mothers and 7 babies that were under our care, and it was way too much. We did it, but it was way, way too much. And so when ratios passed, and that's the law, and do you want me to tell you what that is?
No. Wait, back up a minute. Yeah. Because I think you're, just tell us a little bit more about, first of all, just what a ratio is, where it came from.
Okay. Great. So in general, what a ratio is a ratio is how many nurses, how many patients can one nurse have, to put it most simply? So if I have too many patients to take care of, I'm not going to be able to do all of the things that I need to do for them. I can't monitor them correctly. I can't make sure that they're not, in my case, you know, having bleeding problems or having issues with their blood pressure. All the different things that I do to make sure that the patients are safe, I can't do those things if I have too many patients, because I won't have time.
And who decides? Where is this? Where did you said that there was a change, but where typically do ratios come from?
Ratios came from the California Nurses Association.
No, working... I mean before that. Before? Yeah.
Well, you mean where did ratios originate?
Yeah.
Well, the very first ratios actually happened in California under the first term of Jerry Brown, believe it or not, where they looked at the intensive care units and they said, these nurses can't take care of these critically ill patients if they have too many of them. So the very first ratios happened in the intensive care units in California, where they limited the number of patients the nurses could have.
And before that, the management decided?
Absolutely, the management decided. And really, I mean, as you might imagine, the kind of pressures, I mean, there are a lot of different goals that you have being a healthcare organization. And whether you're a profit, for-profit, or whether you're non-profit, and again, we can talk about that a little later, but there is always a desire in these companies to make money for whatever, you know, if you're non-profit, you know, that's still there. I think that's really confusing to people, but anyway. So there's a lot of different pressures on management, and so those pressures often come to bear on nursing, and whether nurses have adequate resources to do the job that we're tasked to do. I mean, that ratios is one of those things where if I have, you know, too many patients, then the hospitals end up not having to pay out as much for my salary, for the salary of the nurses, right? So they have more money. So there are certain pressures in healthcare to have fewer nurses if that can be accomplished. And so, you know, as nurses, of course, we want to have enough nurses to really give good care. And that, you know, our perspective of what that might look like is different from perspective of the companies and corporations that we work for, or it can be different.
Okay.
It often is different.
Okay, yeah, that's great. So then Jerry Brown and you get ratios?
Well, initially they just got some ratios initially in the ICU, but then in the late 90s, California Nurses Association had identified one of the biggest barriers to providing safe patient care was not having enough nurses at the bedside. And they took it upon themselves to pass a law, because this is not something that the healthcare corporations were doing voluntarily, because they didn't want to. So they passed a law that basically mandated in all of the different places in the hospital — this doesn't impact outside of the hospital, this is only in the hospital — the number of patients that any nurse could have. So, for example, in a medical surgical unit, a nurse could have 5 patients. In an intensive care unit with the most ill patients, they could have 1 or 2. In my particular unit, in the postpartum unit, we could have up to 4 couplets, so 4 moms and 4 babies. So we could have up to 8 patients. And that was transformative, because suddenly it wasn't an argument. We didn't have to go in and say, this patient's too sick, I should have fewer patients, and have that discussion. The law mandated that I could have no more than a certain number of patients. Now,
so the state,
California state law
passed this. Now, am I confused here that the former governor Arnold Schwarzenegger was involved somehow?
You're absolutely not confused. So, soon after that, Governor Schwarzenegger was elected, and Governor Schwarzenegger used an emergency mandate — I can't remember the exact term — to push the ratios aside, to set them aside. They had passed. Governor Davis, his predecessor, had signed it into law, and his first act as governor, Governor Schwarzenegger, did an emergency mandate to suspend the law. And, you know, the reason he did that is because he was asked to do so by the hospital associations and the hospitals, and he did. And so that galvanized the nurses. The nurses, at that point, you know, prior to that, you know, we hadn't actually been very political. We were there to take care of patients, and CNA had been around. They had have a long history, but I would say, in general, that was a really huge galvanizing force for nurses to become active. For me, it was probably a turning point in my life in terms of my own individual political activism, because I had been in that beginning stages of nursing where I was really focused on learning how to be a good nurse and the picking up the knowledge and the expertise to do that. And then I was just starting to look around at that point in my career and say, you know, I could take better care of these patients if I had certain things in place. And ratios passed. And I was, and it allowed us to have a little bit of breathing room, a little bit of a sense of, okay, this argument, at least for now, has been taken off the table. So when that emergency edict went into effect that suspended the ratios, that's when I said, okay, it's time to become active. This I will fight for. This I will go to the streets for, because this is going to impact whether I can safely take care of my patients inside the hospital. And I can't go back to what I did before. Before I didn't know, now I know, and I'm not willing to go back to that. And so I did, you know, I started to learn. I went to classes and started to, connect with my labor rep from California Nurses Association.
Classes sponsored by the union?
CNA, yeah. They did classes about, because ratios, I mean, it's hard to overemphasize, I think, what an impact ratio and what we how transformative it was for the nurses and our practice in the hospital. Suddenly, we could provide better care, and we had a backup. The law was behind us, right? Before, we didn't have anything behind us. We suddenly had a law that dictated that, you know, there was this minimum standard that no one could broach. And so basically the CNA started to follow Schwarzenegger around and basically say, hey, you know, this isn't going to work. You're impacting patients. You're impacting safety. This is not, you know, this isn't going to work. And so I started participating in those things. I remember going to San Francisco and being in an incredible rally with the teachers and the firefighters, where we all joined together. And it was pretty amazing. And, you know, at that point also, Schwarzenegger was, his popularity was hard to underestimate. He was incredibly popular. They were even talking about changing the Constitution so that he could run for president, because he's not born in the United States. So they were going to possibly change the Constitution so that he could run. He was immensely popular. And here we were, the California nurses, saying, no, this isn't okay. We're not going to stand for this. This is something that we need to safely take care of our patients, and we don't care how popular you are. This was the wrong thing to do, and we're going to stand up for it. And believe it or not, I mean, unbelievably, we won. People listened, and he had to back down. And I think that was really also a huge turning point. It was, for me, just individually, it was like I could see that this worked, that this kind of activism, that joining together with other people could have a huge impact on my practice and on, joining together to make a difference and make things better. And so that was kind of it for me. I was kind of hooked, and ever since then I have been increasingly active in trying to be able to safely take care of my patients. I mean, really, for me, it's pretty unbelievable that that's what I have to fight for, frankly. It seems like that really should be a given, that you should be able to walk into a hospital and assume that the priority is to safely take care of the people that are there. And if you assumed that, you would be wrong, unfortunately.
So what happened? The suspension of the ratios was lifted?
Were put back in place. Basically, the California Nurses Association, following Schwarzenegger around and putting things out into the public also became educated, and so they took him to court, and he lost. And there was one point where you might remember this, it was fairly well known at the time, he went into a conference some sort of a women's conference, and the nurses had gone to that conference, and they stood up with a banner about the ratios, and he made fun of the nurses. He basically said, those are those special interests. They hate me because I'm always kicking their butt. And no one could believe that he would say that about the nurses. And that was kind of a real transformative moment, that I think that kind of his intentions and his attitudes were really revealed. And so not only did the court uphold the law, but Schwarzenegger lost a tremendous amount of popularity and, in some ways, I think that was a good part of kind of the downfall of Schwarzenegger. So, kind of an amazing thing.
Yeah, what should we say? Right on.
Yeah, and that was. Imagine. I mean, these are, we're nurses, right?
Way to go! Yeah.
What are we doing out there on the street doing that kind of stuff, right? I mean, but that's what happened. It was like, no way, you're not taking this on. You are not going to do this. This isn't okay. You are not going to make it so that I can't take care of my patients in the hospital. I mean, I have to look those people in the eyes. You know, I have my hands on people that, I hate to be dramatic, but the reality is they can live or die based on what I do with them and my ability to see whether, you know, what's happening with them and to monitor them and to be able to identify when things are going to go wrong. I don't take that lightly. That is like a sacred trust for me, and it's what I've dedicated my life to doing. And I'm not going to, I will stand up to anything that impedes my ability to do that. And that's what I'm tasked to do, even under the law. Nurses are very, very unique, because what the law says is we have to advocate for our patients and the interests of our patients above everything else. So the company that I work for, if they give me, a situation that puts my patients in danger, I'm obligated to stand up for my patient. That's what I have to do.
So looking at my notes, just maybe we can, the last word on ratios. I think you told me that you feel like, you've come full circle now, I think was your phrase. What did you mean, as if that's what
you
said?
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately what's happened is that, back to that law kind of states what the minimum standards should be. So when I say that in the ratios law, it's actually Title 22, that it says that I can only have in my area 4 couplets, so 4 moms and 4 babies. That's supposed to be the minimum. So I'm never supposed to have more than that. But the law goes on to say as well that if my patients are sicker and require more care, I should have fewer than that. So the law, and that is where we have, that's where we're having issues now. So, you know, increasingly, it's, you know, that's where the struggle is to, there's a lot of pressure to make money, right? I mean, we're in a healthcare system where, even if it's a for-profit company, there's a lot of pressure to make money, and so that impacts us at the bedside. And unfortunately, it means that there's a lot of pressures on us to do more, to work faster. Patients are in the hospital for less time; they're sicker than they used to be. We have to discharge them sooner, and as a result, we're working harder and harder and being more and more productive, and yet we're still kind of right at that same minimum of the ratios rather than being able to have all of the resources that we need to really safely take care of our patients. So it's an ongoing struggle.
Well, Katie, let me ask you this. I have a friend who works at St. Joseph's Memorial in Santa Rosa.
Yeah.
And they're on strike, and they've been on strike a couple of times now this fall. And I was talking to the president of their union, and she told me that one of the issues that they have as nurses is that, which I wonder if this is connected, that resources are being taken away from them gradually. And I think she meant like nursing assistants, the people who come and help moving people around are there with supplies and so forth. Could you, is that an issue that you're familiar with?
I think that it's happening everywhere. Yeah. I mean, I think what has happened is that ratios went into place. And when they first went into place, there was, all of the other stuff was also in place. And I think, meaning we had a certain amount of support in the hospital that then has gradually we've lost. So like your friend at St. Joseph said, there are just fewer supportive kinds of resources, not enough care assistance if they're being used, not enough supplies can be an issue depending, there's just a whole slew of things that they have done to kind of decrease costs in caring for patients. And so, yes, those are issues. Having sufficient, clerks, having sufficient, you know, everything, it seems to be, it seems to me, has been sharply reduced. The people who clean the hospital, the environmental services people, you know, we seem to have fewer of those, and it doesn't seem to be, this seems to be across the board in terms of, you know, when I talk to my colleagues that are working for other companies, it's pretty much the same. We're all facing this kind of decrease in support, and it makes it harder, and so you have to work faster, you have to work harder, you have to be more and more increasingly productive, and you know, you really don't want to do that in healthcare. you know, you want to be listening to what the professionals at the bedside say is needed. Right? We're the ones that know what's needed. And nurses, you know, we don't sit around. We generally, we're a pretty hardworking bunch, and we like it when the day goes fast. You know, we like to be, we like to be with our patients at the bedside. That's where we like to be. And so, you know, when we say we need more resources here, generally, it's because we need more resources here. It's because we are asking for the adequate amount to safely take care of those patients. And as you have patients that are sicker and sicker and staying for shorter and shorter periods of time, you can imagine what that does to our workload. It gets increased more and more and more. And at a certain point, you can't do it as well anymore. And so that's where the nurses will step out and step up and say, no. I make a commitment to the place where I work, right? I make a commitment to those patients. But I also expect a commitment in return. And that commitment is, give me what I need to do my job well. And I will fight for that. And that's kind of where we are.
This is KZYX. My name is Cal Winslow. I'm your host of for talking about California. This morning we're talking to Katie Romer, an RN, registered nurse, at Kaiser Permanente in Oakland. We've been talking about the problems of staffing and resources. Katie, just one last thing, and then maybe we could move. It seems to me that you also mentioned to me earlier, and you haven't, I don't think today, but like most work, your work sounds to me, and I've been told by others, that it can be quite stressful. I happen to be married by accident, I guess, to a woman who's a nurse, and she said that a great source of stress and a real problem is feeling when you have to leave someone who hasn't been properly looked after because you have to go on to someone else. Is this what you meant to me when you talked about stress, that you're
it's
not doing
the hardest
your job?
Things. Yeah, I mean, again, it's that whole commitment, right? I come in willing to put it all on the line, you know, and I think the vast majority of nurses do the same. You know, we walk into the hospital every day, and, you know, we don't know what's going to happen. And so you have to be at the top of your game walking in. You know, I mean, I'm going to digress here for just a second, but what happened just recently in New York with the New York hospital at NYU, they had to evacuate because their generator failed. And the nurses had to walk the patients down 9 floors in the dark with some, you know, at least in the case of the most publicized thing was the babies in the intensive care unit. And many of those babies needed to be ventilated, so they had to have someone breathing for them. And they didn't have the ventilators, you know, working at that point. They were on battery, so they had to hand, you know, we call it bag and mask. So they were bagging those babies, you know, ventilating them so that they could breathe while walking down 9 floors in the dark with people holding flashlights with equipment. It took 6 nurses per baby. Well, it wasn't just nurses. It was nurses, it was clerks, it was doctors, it was medical students, anybody they could get that would be able to help, they had. and they had 20 babies that they had to get down. I mean, we live in earthquake country, right? We could be faced with something similar at any time where we would have to, and we're not going to have any warning in an earthquake. And so it just so happened, I saw a blurb on Anderson Cooper where he interviewed one of the nurses, that when that the power went out, they were in shift report, which means that the off-going nurses were giving report to the nurses that were coming on to take care of the babies. So they had twice the amount of people that they normally would have. So when that power went out, everyone stayed, right? So they had double the amount of people that they normally would have had. I really wonder what would have happened had that not happened at that particular time, and they didn't have the amount of people that they would have needed to evacuate all those babies. We are really, you know, we need to have the resources. There is nothing worse than having to look in the face of someone who needs your help and having to go to someone else who might have a more urgent issue in that moment. So, you know, we prioritize all the time. When you have, you know, four different patients that you're caring for, in our case it's eight, you have to prioritize the needs of those patients at any given time. But when you have sicker patients, the prioritization gets a lot trickier. So my first thought when the whole New York City thing happened is, oh my gosh, what if you were in the intensive care unit and you had two patients that were on a ventilator? How do you choose who you ventilate? How do you make that choice? And it speaks to the fact that we have to have it. You can't just staff to the very lowest base all the time and think it's going to work out when things happen. And it may not, that something happening may not just be an emergency like an earthquake or a big storm. It could be something much less of an issue, like you could have a sudden influx of patients that are critically ill in, or more ill into your unit, or you could, you know, have the power go out, or you could have any number of things happen that would require an immediate influx of resources that you might not have if you're only staffed to the very base level. And, you know, so there's the big issues that you face, but also just on a day-to-day. I mean, I can hardly walk at the end of my shift sometimes because I will have just, nurses will take, will you know, their goal is to provide good patient care. So we will sacrifice ourselves in order to give it. So when we're short-staffed, we run harder, sometimes to our own detriment, right? Because we so want to give good care to the patients that, you know, we'll go without having a break. We'll go without eating lunch. We'll go without, you know, going to the bathroom because our patients need us to take care of them, and we do. But then what that does, if you're working in an environment in which the goal is to make money, then what happens is that the organization starts to think that should be the norm, that having nurses run all the time and missing a break or missing going to the bathroom and, you know, making those kinds of, choices about who we see and who we don't see, that seems to be, well, okay, that's the way we'll do it then. We'll run at maximum, you know, pace all the time. But you run real risks with that. One, I don't think that has any place in healthcare because we're not talking about an assembly line here. A mistake means, on my part, means somebody gets hurt, means somebody doesn't get the care that they need. If somebody makes a mistake on a car or, you know, something less, they're making a tool, you can take that tool out of service and it's not that big of a deal. I mean, obviously, if you made a mistake on a car that impacted someone's life, that would be terrible. But generally, you know, that's a lesser kind of a mistake. But we're applying a lot of these same kinds of principles to healthcare. But we're applying them to human beings that are sitting in a bed in the most vulnerable moments of their lives. And that's my responsibility. I, again, have a sacred pact to take care of that human being, and I have to look him in the eye. And so when I have to look somebody in the eye and say, you know, I'm going to be back in just a couple of minutes because I've got this other patient that we have something important going on, that is awful. And that creates a level of stress in the nurses that is, okay, you could have a bad day. We all recognize that things happen in the hospital. But when you're running like that all the time, that doesn't work.
Okay, Katie, take a breath. I'm going to ask you a harder question now.
Yeah.
Just recently, there was quite a big teacher strike in Chicago, and there haven't been so many teacher strikes for, 20, 30 years in this country. And one of the criticisms of the teachers was sort of, how dare you, do this at the expense of our children? And I think that nurses, in a way, get that kind of a response when they try to take action on their own behalf, only much more so.
That's right. Absolutely.
But the CNA, California Nurses Association, is known as a militant union, the one that will take strike action, that will take workplace actions and so forth. How does the CNA and how do you, without going over what you've already said, how do you justify taking action?
Well, first of all, no one ever would call a strike unless they had done all of the other things that would try to resolve the issue before that. A strike is always the last thing that you do, no matter what. So you've negotiated, you've tried to do all of the different processes that would lead to a resolution for whatever the issues are. And if you call a strike, it's because there's nothing else that can be done, right? And so, you can hear from what I just said, there's a lot of, the stakes are really high. So I guess what I say, is what if we didn't have that option? So, we're talking about being able to provide safe patient care for patients and having the adequate resources to do so and having a certain amount of control over our practice. So what if a strike is usually, historically right now, the strikes that have been called, by CNA have been one-day strikes, right? So, the hospital is given the legal notice, so they have at least 10 working days to prepare for that. And call in and train and do what they need to do to prepare to provide safe care. They're noticed. There's that whole process that goes into place that allows them to put into practice, that allows them to transfer patients out of a hospital, to, provide for trained people to come in and take care of the patients that are there, that allow them to not accept new patients prior to anything that would happen. There's a lot of things that happen over the course of something like that. And still people are like, yeah, but maybe nurses shouldn't strike at all. Maybe nurses shouldn't be able to strike. And I guess this is me speaking, this is Katie Romer speaking, and I guess my own personal thing is, what if we couldn't? What if we've done everything that we can do to try to get what we need to take care of our patients, and we're still not getting what we need to do so? Do you take that off the table and then, on a daily basis, if you're not getting what you need to take care of patients, what's more dangerous, a one-day strike or an ongoing thing that just continues to deteriorate and patients get less and less of what they need?
Okay, and I should tell listeners that I've met you several times, Katie, but most of the time when I meet you, you're on a picket line. And I know that the listeners will know that that's not all you do.
Yeah.
But and quite often it's been with a microphone in front of you, and you're rallying the nurses, I should say, extremely effectively. And twice when I saw you in action in downtown Oakland, it was not just in support of nurses and CNA members, but was in support of other hospital workers, in this case members of the National Union of Healthcare Workers, the NUHW. Can you justify that?
Yeah. actually. I can, because we all work together, and we're all working toward the same thing, which is providing adequate and safe patient care. And so, you know, it is incumbent on us to do what we can. I mean, there's a long history in the United States of working people coming together to stand up for the kind of rights that they have, right? And so I've kind of made it my business to learn just a little bit about that, because I feel like the history of it's really, really important. And so I think we're in one part of that history where working people in the last, I don't know, 20 years, maybe I'm exaggerating a little bit, haven't had the experience of that so much. So, but those are our rights. These are our legal rights, and they exist for a reason. They exist because they allow us to redress, to ask for redress for issues that are wrong. So, you know, if we only have unlimited power on the part of the corporations that exist in our country, where does that lead us? Well, I think it leads us down a path where, you know, basically where we're heading now, where people don't have, we don't have jobs that pay well for people, where we don't have people who can retire with dignity, where we don't have, you know, people who have adequate medical care to take care of themselves, because those things can be taken away and removed from them. And so from my perspective, if other people don't have those things, especially in the face of the corporations, the healthcare corporations that are making unbelievable amounts of money. I mean, in this recession, this recession since 2008 that we've had, the healthcare corporations have made more money than they ever have. They have billions and billions of dollars in profit.
Kaiser,
they're profitable or non-profitable. So,
Kaiser
how can
included?
They say to NUHW workers, "You don't deserve to make a decent living"?
Yeah.
That's unconscionable, I think.
And I just wanted you to bring in Kaiser here because they're doing pretty well.
Kaiser's doing unbelievably well. Like the Sutter Corporation, Kaiser has made billions of dollars in profit, even though they're a nonprofit. It's hard to call them a nonprofit when they're making that kind of money. So, you know, they've made a lot of money. And, you know, one of the really big issues for NUHW was access to psychiatric care, because a lot of the NUHW workers were people who provided psychiatric care, and they didn't have the staff to be able to get patients in to be able to see them. That impacted not only the patients, which in and of itself is enough, but it also impacted everybody else, including the nurses, because those patients then would end up in crisis in the hospital where, you know, they didn't necessarily have to end up depending on what was going on with them. So, yeah, we thought it was really important to, you know, stand up for, you know, what was going on with their patient population as well. And then in the face of that, they had, you know, some, horrific takeaways in the face of Kaiser making the kind of money that it was making.
So, Katie, we just have about a minute left. In the bigger picture, do you or CNA members, healthcare workers, do you have your own thoughts about the future of the healthcare system in this country? Is there anything you'd like to say about that? You know, what's been called healthcare reform?
Oh, I mean, I'm going to speak personally here because, you know, I'm not really in a position to put forth all of CNA's position on it. But, you know, look, healthcare reform had some components to it that that were decent components. Not having, you know, people have, you know, be excluded from healthcare for pre-existing conditions, that's great. Having few kids be able to stay on their parents' plan until they're 26, all of those are great. It doesn't address one of the main problems in healthcare, which is kind of what we've been talking about this whole time, which is having the kinds of resources dedicated to the patients that we need. The costs of healthcare are increasing astronomically. And frankly, you know, I support, and CNA also supports, a single-payer system, Medicare for all. that, you know, when you have insurance companies that are taking 30 cents out of every dollar out of the equation, and none of that money goes toward patient care, you've got a problem.
So, Katie, I have to call this to an end. It's really been informative and interesting and inspiring, really. And I want to say thanks, Katie Romer. Katie's a RN at Kaiser Oakland, and she's been talking to us today about her work. And I should also say good luck to you and the sisters and brothers in the California Nurses Association. And this is KZYX, and I'm Cal Winslow, and I'll be back again next week, Thursday at 9. Good morning.